fourth workshop. Let's see, this one is Bondage of Self. Oh, my gosh. I think anybody can do this one, huh? Let's see. Okay, the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we are almost in collision with someone or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like the actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players on his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, there's a misprint. Okay. If only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he is more likely to have varied traits. So, all right, so the fourth one, workshop, we are going to go with Mindy first, Christian second, and David third. So you want to start?
Yay. I would love to. Hey, guys, I'm Mindy. I'm a drug addict.
Hi, Mindy.
It is aggressive, isn't it? So I have a home group. I have a sponsor, women, and all that stuff. My sobriety date is March 15th, 2019, so I'm in my terrible twos up here. Man, God's so funny having me do shit like this, you know what I mean? Like it's just funny to be talking about the bondage of self, like, while I feel like I'm absolutely wrapped up in it, you know what I mean? And it's like, it started, and like I walk in the room and I'm like, oh, it's not that big, you know, it's gonna be okay, you know. And then the first speaker speaks and I'm like, holy crap, you know, like, whoa. And then the next, and I'm just like, I start feeling like I need to do something, I need to be something, me, I, right? And that's where all my problems happen, right? Like, I got 99 problems, and bondage of self is every single one of them, I promise you. Like, I love how he said, like, I don't have a drug problem. I had a drug solution to a spiritual problem. Man, and that's what it was like my whole life. It was just like the wick of a candle. It was just getting lower and lower and lower. You know what I mean? In this first requirement, right, that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. I wasn't convinced of that when I first came in the rooms. I did like 2 years of everything but fully surrendering to this process, and what I got was nil. If you don't know, nothing, jack shit, right? Relapse. And I had a bunch of self-knowledge and a little bit of awareness, but nothing by the means of peace and serenity, right? Most people try to live by self-propulsion. That's what I was trying to do. I heard a speaker one time, and he was talking about self-propulsion in, like, an analogy, and I love those because, like, I'm an artist, and I need to see it, you know what I mean? And he was talking about how it's like a balloon, right? And, like, what's his name? He was Zach, right? He was talking about, when I come here, I have to be absolutely deflated. Well, like, the problem for me is I've been absolutely deflated, like, several times, okay? You know what I mean? But the problem is I get a little bit of air, get a little wind in me, you know what I mean? I figured out what the problem is again, right? So now I come into rehab, I'm deflated, right? Empty, starting to get a little air back, and then I go like this, self-propulsion, right? Flat again. I've heard people say this, and it was so true for me, right? Like, there's two surrenders that happen in recovery. The first is to drugs and alcohol, right? The second one is to self, and man, that one is a wake-up call, you know what I mean? I did these steps before. I said this third step prayer. I didn't really believe in God. I was kind of miserable, so I was like, you know, maybe God will catch it, like, right? Like, I've said this before, it's like a Hail Mary pass in a football game. I'm going to throw it, you know, maybe it'll catch it. If it catches it, I will believe it. I'll see it. It'll be great. I'll be on team higher power. You know what I mean? I'll do that, right? But, like, I don't have time to wait and see if a higher power is going to catch that ball. You know, this is not a game to me. This is my life. And I don't trust anybody. Can't trust myself. I certainly don't trust a higher power. You know, it wasn't until I was actually fully fucking depleted and I ran out of options, right? Like, there's another quote I love. Like, there will come a point when you can't put anything between you and you anymore. That's where the surrender happens, right? I finally got to this place. I don't know what else to try. I've dated every girl, you know. I've tried the steps, but I didn't try the steps with God in them. You know what I mean? And then for me, like, coming from a super religious family, I was super angry at this God idea, right? I'm a flaming homosexual, if you cannot tell. Hey, that's me, right? So it was like, that's the last fucking thing I wanted, I promise you. But I was so miserable. Okay, I'll get on my knees. I'll pray to a God that I hate because I have no other options, you know? There's something I do with my sponsees. I think it was Sandy Beach, and he was talking about it, right? And for me, I regurgitate it a lot. I'm parroting, Craig. I'm parroting. But, like, for me, it was so vital. Like I said, this visual of how do I surrender? Like, you're telling me, like, I tell my sponsees, surrender, and they're like, fuck you. You know, like, what does that mean? Like, this doesn't stop. How do I put that down, right? And he's talking about the difference between faith and trust, right? Like, I can have all the faith in the world, and I still won't let God be God in my life, right? I need trust. And he's talking about these people at a circus, right? And then there's these tightrope walkers, and they're up, and they're walking on this tightrope, right? And you're in the crowd, and you have faith that they can do it, right? They practice. They're circus people. They can do this, right? But it's a little scary. And then they get this wheelbarrow out, and they start pushing each other in it, right? If I had trust that they could do it, I'd climb up that ladder, and I'd get in that wheelbarrow, right? And to me, like, that's just a beautiful analogy because, like, but let's be honest, it's really freaking easy to put the stupid shit in the wheelbarrow, the hard stuff, my addiction. I don't want that. I am convinced I can't beat that. That's easy to let go of. Oh, my dog's sick. I know I can't heal her. I'm going to put that in there. But do I put my relationship? Do I put my health? Do I put the things that I think I can affect and maneuver and change? No, I don't, right? And I might put something up there and take it down a million times, right? And when I do that, like, it's because I'm back thinking that I know how to do this better than God does, you know? And, man, to keep it current. So I've got a chronic illness, right? Addiction, right? I've got another one. I've had it about a decade, okay? I got that before I started drinking and using, okay? And before that, I was addicted to your approval. I was addicted to things outside of myself because that's where I was getting my self-worth, right? And when I got sick, I started to lose all of those things, and that's where I found my drug solution, right? Like, I don't just want people's approval. I need it. I needed it, right? When I'm high, I don't need shit from you. I'm okay. You know what I mean? And, like, I didn't know how to get to that place on my own. But I don't even know what I was saying. This is self. I'm probably, like, stopping what God's trying to do. You know, like, I kept praying, like, God, just please keep me out of the way. You know, like, I think that I need to come stand up here and add something to this. Like, this has been so freaking beautiful. Like, everybody that has shared, it has been so beautiful. I've seen it not only for me. I've seen it for people that I love and care about. I've seen they're broken open and their hearts are touched. I'm not standing up here to add to it. I think I need to. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to enlighten you with my 2 years of bullshit. You know what I mean? But I got nothing, you know? But, yeah, like, I don't, I really, that is all I have. I love y'all.
Hello. I'm Christian. I'm an addict. So the bondage of self, like, I suffered from the bondage of self, I mean, 8, 9, 10 years old. I didn't know it then. It's interesting because so much of what I understand now in recovery and the principles only comes from hindsight. It's like my awareness and understanding comes from looking back and being like, oh, that's what that was. It's almost like I understood the first step only looking back. Like I had a first step experience and then the sponsor took me through it. And then I was like, oh, yeah, there, yep, that's it. So like the bondage of me came from me being obsessed with how I looked to you, because my core belief is that there's something wrong with me and that I am not good enough and that I am defective. So the way I dealt with that was I created this alter ego in the bondage of self to kind of deflect my core beliefs about myself. And that alter ego was this alpha male. And I would bully you and I would beat you at all cost. And that's who I became at a very young age. And that kind of deflected, you know, at least I portrayed something to you. I didn't believe it, but that's what I portrayed. And so, like, I extended that all the way through my addiction. And I perpetuated this lie to myself that I was this thing. And what I became in that process was really a victim. Like, I played God with myself because I would interact with you, and then I would walk away and, like, you should have done this. You should have said this. They think you're an idiot. And I constantly, the screws just kept tightening because I would analyze a conversation that I had with you for days. Or even worse, I would rehearse a conversation that I was about to have with someone. And it's that bondage. Like, I'm enslaved to a simple interaction. So when I created this kind of this persona, what I ended up doing was I got to play God with you because you're an idiot. And then I'm not talking to myself anymore. And I really played victim. And the only way I could get it is get away from any of it was using. And I'm a guy that went to the mental institution 4 times. I went to detox 5 times. I've been to jail for a long time. And then one long-term treatment. And I did awesome. Like, I ran shit in the mental institution. Like, I thrived. Like, there was this guy, Jim. Jim was my dude. And he couldn't, I don't know what was wrong with Jim, but he shook. And I had him, dude, it was great. I thought it was great. I would be like, Jim, coffee. And he'd get up, and, you know, they didn't give us caffeine, but he would go get coffee, and he shook the shit out of his hands, and so his cup would be empty by the time he got back to us. And I'd wait about 10 minutes, and I'd be like, Jim, coffee. And they finally came to me, and they're like, stop creating chaos. Like, here's extra meds. Go lay down. But I did great in these settings because I was all loaded. I was loaded, and when you're managing my life, I do okay, and when this is going crazy, I don't. So I don't even understand any of that until I'm looking back and I have some perspective. So by the time I came into the rooms the first time, I'm separated from drugs and alcohol. So I am completely in bondage of self, and I'm sitting there, and I've got this meeting sheet. Some of y'all know what that is. And I put it in the basket, and I'm so wrapped up in the bondage of self that I'm listening to y'all share, and I'm like, Jesus, I don't care what you're saying. I hate all of you. Just sign my meeting sheet and let me get out of here. And I didn't make it very long because I just hated everything about it. My life was completely unmanageable. I was wrapped up in myself. I couldn't talk to you. I couldn't stop talking to myself. And I didn't last very long. But the next time I came in, I actually got a sponsor. And I started going through the steps. And I remember the first time I ever heard bondage of self was when I did the 3rd step with this sponsor. And he had me get on my knees, and we said this prayer. And I remember looking up, like when you would dose acid, and you'd be like, bro, you feel it yet? You feel it? And I remember standing up from saying this 3rd step prayer and being like, did anything happen? I don't know. But so then it was awesome because I just stumbled across a different meeting. And it was a meeting of Drug Addicts Anonymous. And I go into this little room and these people are on fire. And I hear this woman sharing, and I didn't know it then. It's that kind of that hindsight perspective, but I worked my second step right there. Because when I believe that this works for you, I've done my second step. I didn't know it, and she ended up taking me through it again. I backdoored her into sponsoring me because she sponsored my ex-wife, and I was like, hey, you don't have a license. I got to drive you. So when she comes, when I take you over there to do this work, you tell her that, like, I'm just going to stay since I'm your ride home. And I stayed, and I never left. And she took me through this work at the same time as the first sponsor. And it's an odd experience, and it was just mine. But I went through this work, and she showed me how I was playing the victim. And she showed me through my fourth and fifth step how I was in the bondage of self. And when you have this core belief that you are a piece of shit, this work comes very easily. Because you can see your side of things very easily. Where I had kind of told myself I'm the victim in all this, I changed my perspective, and I'm like, I'm not the victim, I'm the perpetrator. I'm the perpetrator to everyone around me. And it was this amazing awakening to see how I had been in the bondage of self for so long, my whole life. And I did very well, and I started sponsoring, and I started getting these things back, and you guys started telling me I'm a pretty good guy, and a couple of idiots asked me to sponsor them. And I'm getting all these promises. My first sponsor used to call them predictable results. So I'm getting these predictable results. Like, if you do what the book says, you get what the book promises. And that was absolutely true in my experience. Fast forward a few years. And when your core belief is that you're a piece of shit, you kind of turn your will in your life over the care of God as you understand him. But then that weird 6 and 7 comes in. And when your core belief is that you're a piece of shit and the only thing you've been taught is to see how you're at fault, then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You see, I knew this work worked. And I became so rigid with it that I would, in all situations, I would look at how am I at fault? How am I at fault? How am I at fault? And I never went outside that. And I get years into this, and I can't figure out what's going on. And I called Zach. And I said, I don't know what's going on. What's going on? I don't like myself. And he was like, well, if you've hit a place where what you're doing is not working, you need to do something else. And I am at this point a big book thumper. And, you know, I'm kind of parroting what I'd been taught. You don't put yourself on the inventory. You don't make amends to yourself. You damn sure don't ever let me catch you uttering a positive affirmation. Like, you're a piece of shit. That is the freedom in this program, is you're always wrong. And it worked very well for me for a long time. And then I started noticing, I love my sponsor, my current sponsor, so much, but he looks at me at the gym one day and he's like, how come you can't look me in the eye when I compliment you? Because I hate myself. And saying it out loud was weird. And he's like, we might want to work on that. And that was like a month before I hit the wall and called Zach. And he's like, you got to do something. You got to put yourself on an inventory. And I'm like, oh, God, no. He's like, you got to do something, bro, because I can hear it in your voice. And so I did affirmations. I did affirmative prayer. And I did more work. And what I saw through this work is that I was a single father, not a piece of shit. I was the caretaker for my stage 4 father, not a piece of shit. I had this beautiful, amazing woman who was about to marry me and trust me with her kids, not a piece of shit. All of the evidence in my life was speaking directly against the core belief that I'm a piece of shit. And so what I saw was, I was back into the self-obsession and the bondage of self. And it led, like, I hit another bottom and I had another awakening. And it was beautiful to realize that I had become so rigid, I had to do a little something else. I had to be willing to look at something different, because I had worked through the bondage of self, and I had gotten that hindsight and that perspective, and I got to see, well, this was how bondage of self looked my whole life, and I got some freedom, and then I got back in it. It is weird to say that the rigidity that I was taught led me back into the bondage of self. And the very same work that someone else in this program told me to do, hey, just look at it a little different. And it was so painful to hear anything other than I'd been taught the first time, gave me freedom. And it was beautiful. And I'm not a piece of shit, turns out. Like, I got to bury my dad a month ago. And my sisters, you know, I'm making amends and all these things. And they kind of were like, yeah, bro, congratulations. We're glad you're not dead. Stay away from us. And this is 5 years since I've made those amends. And we're cordial. And my dad passes. And so all of us are home. And these same sisters are like leaning on me. And they're saying, how have you become such a solid person? And I'm like, aren't recovered drug addicts awesome? And they're like, yes. Yes. What do you do? My sister, the attorney, I'm sure it tasted like lemons for her to say this, but she was like, what do you do? She was like, I don't know if I need to smoke weed or do meditation. And I was like, I don't know. You might be able to smoke weed. I can't, but I can tell you how to meditate. You know what I mean? So it's beautiful. The restoration, you know, it took a while and I had some things to work through. But the idea is they were complimenting me. Took me 5 years to accept a compliment. Took me 5.5 to be able to look you in the eye when you complimented me. And that was how the bondage of self looked for me. And I had to, you know, get some perspective to see that even sober, I could get back into the bondage of self and self-obsession. So that's all I got. Thank you.
My name's David Gibbs. I'm an alcoholic and a drugaholic and a chocolate chip cookie-aholic. You put a holic on the end of it, and I'm it. You know what I mean? My drug of choice was more. And you were nervous, weren't you? You are the epitome of what it means to overcome bondage of self. You know that, right? There's God's love written all over your face. Have the courage to come up here and stand up here in front of a bunch of people who like if you want what we got, you got to do what we do. And then you get up here and you're like, what do they want from me? What is it that they see? Because I'm not sure I believe it myself, right? And to be up, you know, and to speak in front of people and to be in a position like that where you're a recovered person from this stuff. You know what I mean? And it's like, do I really have what it takes to give this to somebody else? Right? And that's bondage of itself. And right there, that's the definition. It's funny, the definition, okay? I'm up in the room earlier because I was going to talk on something else, a different panel this week, right? And then they kind of switched me over to this. I had a great talk for the other one. So I'm winging this all the way. I got a, like, coffee and allergy meds going on me. I'm like, I'm all amped up and vibrating right now. Because I got this sinus infection and just trying to stay awakened with it. I'm like, well, I better look up the definition of like self-bondage, right? And I did. It's all like this sexual stuff. And I'm like, well, they'd probably like to hear that. And it had this one definition in there about like getting all tied up, right? And then the keys to the handcuff are in an ice cube and you can't get it out till the ice cube melts. And my head's like, I wonder how big that ice cube is. Is it like a block of ice? Or is it one of those little ones? You know? And that's just the way my head works. You know what I mean? I'm stuck with it. My sober date's May 16th, 1992. And you would think that after 29 years, I would have a handle on this thing. To the point where I would read something like that, and my brain wouldn't go there, right? But if I'm going to look at the bondage of self and try to give a talk on it and try to relay to you guys some information about that, right? One of the biggest deals in Alcoholics Anonymous that I learned from my first sponsor was if you're going to get up there and you're going to say anything, you better know what the hell you're talking about, because what you do not want to do in any group, whether it be AA, I was raised in AA or DAA or CA or whatever A you want, just pick the aholic and go there, is you do not want to misinterpret what we're trying to do here in Alcoholics Anonymous or DAA or NA, because there is a specific message that they're trying to give you. So that's a big responsibility. And so to get up here and try to do that, it's like it scares the crap out of me, right? Because I still have that bondage of self, and I don't want to screw that up. What he said to me had depth and weight, and I took it very seriously to the point where I would get scared to share in a meeting. I would get scared to go on that panel at the treatment center because what could they possibly want from me? The grass was always greener, right, on the other side. And let me tell you, when you're in the bottom of a dumpster and you're leaning over and you're handing your little girl who's 8 years old cans so you guys could get a Happy Meal and another bottle of whiskey, the frickin' grass is greener on the other side. It really is. And now that I don't live there anymore, I can look back and go, no, the grass isn't greener over there, right? There is something better, and it starts here for people like us. So the bondage of self appears in the third step prayer. And it says, relieve me of the bondage of self. And when I was confronted with doing my third step prayer, which absolutely terrified me, the fourth step, I was cool, man. I didn't have a problem telling my sponsor anything because by the time we got there, me and him had had a lot of conversations. And I was very open with him. And I knew that was going to be a requirement because this is like my fourth time through a 12-step program. It wasn't my first. And I kind of had an idea. My dad's been sober for 46 years in AA. My mom's been in Al-Anon for like 50 years. So I grew up around all this stuff. And there was always that conflict of, there's David, a little drug addict, dropping acid and smoking weed and drinking at keggers and all this stuff. And my mom and dad are running off the AA meetings and getting religious. And that's the way I looked at it. So I really didn't have a problem because I kind of knew what to expect when I was actually here for the last time because I wanted to get better this time. I didn't want to be the guy handing his daughter aluminum cans anymore. So I started, you know, asking the right questions, I guess. What does it mean, bondage of self? What does that mean, you know? And he backtracked. He said, let's go back to the beginning of We Agnostics. And it starts out and it says, we hope you've learned something about the real alcoholic. And that we've made the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. And I knew that. He had taught me that stuff. And I agreed. I could raise my hand and say that I was an alcoholic and a drug addict without any shame anymore and without any guilt. I knew that there was some form of a sickness going on in my body that was a bad reaction to these things that most of the people don't suffer from. And that would explain to me why my friends at the biker bar would tell me, Dave, if you've been doing that stuff, don't come around here. I'm like, these guys outdrink me all the time. They've done more methamphetamine than I could even poke a stick at. But they're telling me, you're different when you do that stuff. And so my sponsor told me why I was different when I do that stuff. And I was able to, like, intellectualize it at some level and say, yeah, okay, I'm one of you guys. And I didn't feel ashamed anymore. I just felt like I got to do something about it, right? He made me look at some other stuff in step one and two, that unmanageability and the insanity, and we made a connection with those things. And it's like, I'm so screwed, right? I'm so screwed. You know, what do we do now, right? And he takes me back to that We Agnostics. And Marion touched on it a little bit when she talked, because it says in the we agnostics in there. It tells us about the steel iron girder, right? Electrons whirling around each other at light speed. How is this possible? You know, and it's like it has intelligence, and it's, and I have a kind of a, like a scientific mind, and I want to rip that stuff up and get into it and see. And you know, when at the end of the day, when it boils down to it, I don't freaking care what is involved with a steel iron girder. All I want to do is take my daughter to the playground, put her on a railroad tie, and let her walk across it because it's fun for her, right? If I climb up in the Empire State Building, which is full of steel iron girders, I really don't care as long as it don't fall down. But for some reason, when you present me a concept that there's a higher power, this God, right, and I don't know nothing about it, I defiantly say, no frickin' way, man. I can't do it. Because in my mind, I was conceding to everything, my parents and everybody that was good, and all the grass is greener people on the other side were trying to tell me, is that something has to change, Dave, and it's more than just quitting the drugs and the alcohol. You are a bad person. And I was. And I didn't know how to beat that. I could stop drinking. I could stop using for little bits of time, but I was still a bad person. I'm talking like 30 days or 60 days tops, you know, on my own. And but I was still that guy, you know, and I couldn't shake that stuff. So as he's taking me through this stuff and he's asking me these questions, and the part Marion hit on was, ask yourselves what these conceptions mean to you. I was always sitting in a meeting, or I would go to church with my parents or whatever, and I was always looking at the conception that you were trying to present to me. And deep down inside, I knew I can't live up to that. And the bondage of that kind of self paralyzed me from doing anything productive my entire life. Because what it meant was the trap door would shut. And now that it's shut, I'm like a rat in a cage and I got to get out. And I'm gnawing and clawing and biting and doing everything I can to get out. And all it takes is that one little crack of the door. And I'm out and I'm running. And I'm running amok. And I'm biting and I'm scratching at you. Now, how does one overcome those things? And they're saying that, well, in this third step prayer, we're going to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. And I'm thinking, you know, that sounds pretty drastic, right? And I wanted to stay sober more than I wanted to get loaded. So I told my sponsor, okay, I'll do it. I'll do it. And then he pointed out the reason why we do it. I was convinced that I was going to hang around AA long enough, do the things that you guys did, and that I would have a better life, which meant a better car, a better wife, a better job, all that kind of stuff. I was convinced that that's what it was. That's what I'm going to get out of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I started looking at that third step prayer. And you know what it says in the bottom of that prayer? It says, when ready, we say something like this. It doesn't say, just go in, just do it. I don't think about step one and go, yeah, I put a lot of time out there. I guess I qualify. And, you know, okay, God concept, yeah, let's go with it. Let's turn my will and my life over. It didn't happen like that for me. I didn't even start working the steps till I had 6 months sober. Because I had an overwhelming spiritual experience in a hotel room the night before I got sober. And I thought that disqualified me from working the steps because I had a spiritual awakening. You poor bastards got to go through all that stuff to experience what I experience. And 6 months later, I'm ready to shoot myself in the head or go out to drink. And drinking was the better option. And I was walking out the door and my sponsor bounced me right back in. He was late for the meeting. How does that happen? Literally walking out the door to go to the bar because I just can't take it anymore. The pain of not having any solution to my problem became so great that I needed some relief. I needed the ease and comfort that everyone was talking about earlier in these meetings. I needed that sense of, like, get out of myself, that bondage of self that we're talking about. And I said, Dennis, what do I have to do? I just looked up. I said, what do I have to do? He said, it's about time, asshole. And he always called me that. You know? And But he says, come with me. And we went out and we sat in his car and he started calling me David. I thought he forgot my name. I just thought because I never called him and I never did anything with him. I just sat around AA and complained about everything. And like Ben, I threw tables at people and stuff when I didn't like what they had to say. And, yeah, Angry Dave. Everyone's got a nickname, right? Yeah, I went from Dumpster Dave to Angry Dave. So I'm going through this process, and he's taking me through all this stuff in the backseat of his car about the doctor's opinion and all that stuff. And we fast forward to where I'm at now, and he told me when ready. He says, don't do this unless you're ready. Because if you're not ready, it ain't going to do squat for you. He goes, you got to feel something. You're going to have to feel the desperation of what we're talking about. And what are we talking about? The bondage of self. For me, what it was looking at that stuff that was unmanageable in my life. And he said, let's talk about that. He says, why don't we just sit down here, me and you, and we'll make a list of these things. And he says, let's leave drugs and alcohol out of the question. Okay, my marriage is screwed up. She's run off with some other guy, taking the kids. Still doing a bunch of meth, running wild with them bikers. It's just horrible. What else? Well, my finances are screwed up. And he made me compartmentalize everything that was going on in my life. And there was like 10 things, ranging from my thinking to my emotional state, my health, right? My relationships with my immediate family, with friends, where I worked several months before because I hadn't been there in a long time. And he made me write a little bit about each one of those things and how they got that way. And then in step two, in that insanity that they talk about, they come in to believe that a power greater than myself could relieve me of that. And I'm like, he says, I want you to write down and think about the things that you do over and over and over again, trying to solve those things that are so unmanageable. You know? Well, I spend money frivolously on things that I don't need. That would solve my financial problem. With my marriage, I was the king of the castle when I was out there getting loaded. She was my rock at home. She took care of the kids, the house, the shopping, all that stuff. And when I got home, I was the king of the castle. I'm the breadwinner. If it wasn't for you or for me, you wouldn't have any place to go. And I treated her like crap. And I called her names that she shouldn't be called. And no wonder she went out and found somebody else. So maybe if I treated a woman with a little dignity, maybe I wouldn't get that cold shoulder all the time, right? And so the list went on, and I found all these different ways I could go back maybe someday, maybe, if I get the chance. Obviously, I couldn't do it myself. I was convinced that no human power could do it for me. I'm to the point where I'm almost willing to, like, let God in a little bit. But he said, when ready, we say something like this. And the wording's quite optional. I didn't have to do that prayer exactly the way that it's laid out. Dr. Bob didn't. If you guys ever get a minute and you want to look at Dr. Bob's third step prayer, Google it. He's like, I screwed it all up so bad and I don't know what to do and you got to help me or I'm dead. It's just point blank. It's out there. So I was reading those kinds of things, and I started asking people how they did their third step prayer and whatnot. And I told my sponsor, I think I'm ready for this thing. And a group of people gathered together outside the meeting hall, and they all got on their knees in the middle of the desert out in California. It was 110 degrees, and the asphalt was probably 130 degrees. And there was guys in shorts, and they all got on their knees and held hands. And they all went around the circle and said a third step prayer until it got to me. And then I recited that prayer. And they told me there was one thing that prayer is all about, and it ain't about me. It says so that we can bear witness to those that we might help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. It had nothing to do with me. And I'm thinking it's all about all this crap and all the stuff I've done and that caused all the guilt and the shame that made me do it. No, it's our first avenue of jumping into service and asking God to help us do that. It's the first place in the book where our directions tell us to do that. And it's terrifying. Because what do I have to offer these people? I'm only on my third step. What do I have to offer? And so they started making me go on treatment center places, you know, and go talk on the treatment center place. And we're going to go down to the convention. Why don't you join us, Dave? And I was angry Dave, remember. No one talked to me. I stayed to myself, and I liked it that way, right? And I'm going to close with the mop story, I guess. You heard it the other – some of you guys heard it the other day at a meeting, but I'm going to tell it anyway. I was trying to, like, be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was homeless. I slept in my car behind the meeting hall, so I was always there for them first 6 months. That's where I lived. And they would say, Dave, you need to be a service. I'd say, okay. And I wouldn't do nothing. Dave, you should pitch in a little and do something around here. And, okay, I wouldn't do nothing. And this went on and on. Talked to a few guys. Talked to Steve from Harley-Davidson. He was a mechanic at Harley-Davidson. You know, he told me, you better hope there's a God and you better hope he's willing to help you or you're screwed. And he jumped on his motorcycle and drives away. And I'm thinking, man, this was the guru guy. He was supposed to solve all my problems, and he did. Because a few minutes later, I'm thinking, you know, that's the only thing I never did, is I never gave God a fair shake and invite him into my life to try to do something with this piece of shit that I've become. And so here they come. You got to be a service, Dave. You got to be a service. So finally, I'm like, I surrender. Okay, I'll be a service. We'll talk to Ike. And Ike started the club. And he was like 40 years sober, old man, old, feeble old man. And he said, Dave, on Sundays, we mop the floors and stuff around here after the 11 o'clock meeting. If you'd come and mop the floors, we'd appreciate it. I said, okay, I'll do it. So Sunday I went to the meeting, was waiting around afterwards. Everybody had driven away. I'm in the parking lot, and there's nobody left. And I'm thinking, I'm off the hook. Ike's not here. So I go inside, and there's a guy in there, and he's filling up a mop bucket and in the sink. And he said, can I help you? I said, yeah, Ike told me to come here and help mop the floors after the meeting. And the guy hands me the mop, and he walks out. And so I did what I said I was going to do. I moved the chairs. I mopped the floor. I moved everything back to the other side, mopped the floor. And while it's drying, I'm cleaning ashtrays and coffee cups and scrubbing toilets and just trying to stay busy. And it took all afternoon to do all this stuff. And I got all done, and I stood back there in that empty AA hall, and I went, man, that shit never looked so good. You know? And then I went to the 6 o'clock meeting that night, and here comes this guy. Sloshing coffee all over the place, spilling on my floor, and I'm running up to him with his paper towels, wiping it up, going, you son of a bitch, I worked all day on this, you know, still angry Dave, right? But I had started working the steps with my sponsor. I kept on doing that, and then that became my floor. That was my floor, and I took ownership of that place. And my sponsor's working through these steps, and I'm learning how to be a little bit less selfish, a little bit more helpful. And people are saying to me, Dave, the floors look good. Okay, thanks. About time they recognize my exceptional talent. Hey, Dave, we'd like you to come out for coffee, you know, it'd be really nice, you know. I don't have money for that. No, we'll buy you a piece of pie. So I'd go and they'd. And then the old-timers would share their stories at the coffee at Denny's, right? And I got to know these guys, and we started sharing experiences together at the coffee. And then they said, why don't you bring your kids out to the picnic? And see, now I'm getting my kids back a little bit at a time. And eventually I got custody of them and raised them, sole custody of the two kids. And they're giving me grandkids now. But they said, bring the kids out to the park. And I took them to the park, and they got a loaf of bread, and they fed the ducks, and they were happy, and they were playing with the other little sober kids, and they were laughing. And I hadn't seen the kids laugh in a long, long time and have that kind of pure joy, just happy to be there, dancing in the sunshine, living in the sunlight of the Spirit. And I wanted that. I wanted what my kids had. And I realized that the bondage of self that I'd been living with, especially in AA without any solution for 6 months, was getting worse. And I wanted what they got. And I wanted to feel the sunlight of the Spirit on my face like they were. And I knew I had to give this thing my all. I knew it, man. And I started frivolously vigorous action after we did that third step prayer, my fourth step. And so I'm mopping and I'm cleaning up, and I'm starting to be less angry and more part of the group. And I started to become a member of the Open Door Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wasn't just a guy attending meetings anymore. I was going to some business meetings. They let me secretary. Out here, you guys, chair meeting. Out there, they call it secretary a meeting. And they let me lead my own meeting, you know. And it was 10:30 at night on a Tuesday, you know. The new guys get the crappy jobs. That's just the way it goes around here. And I started to feel something change inside of me. I wasn't quite sure what it was and why I had to do this and why I had to bear witness to somebody else so that they could be free too. And about 6 months into me mopping the floors, here comes a guy in after the 11 o'clock meeting after everybody's gone. And he walks in the back and he says, Ike sent me down here to mop the floors. So I handed him the mop and I walked out. Because that thing I was feeling inside of me, it was a love for an alcoholic that I never felt before. I knew that if I didn't have him to mop, that he would not have the opportunity that I had to be a member of the Open Door Fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he might miss this deal. And no words needed to be said. I handed him the mop and I walked out. And I knew that. And I knew something changed inside of me. And I cared and loved for another human being in a fashion that I had never, ever experienced in my life. And you people gave that to me. And you tolerated me. And you put up with me. And you knew I was suffering from the bondage of self. And you didn't walk out on me. You didn't tell me to leave. You just said, Dave, why don't you try this? And I did. And it worked. And I love you all for that. Thank you.
Good gosh. Man. Oh, thank you, all three of you. Man, that was... Just powerful. The weekend's just been, man, I don't know about y'all, but man, there's so much that's made me want to be just a better husband, a better son. So, we will end this, and we will be back at 8 o'clock.